Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. It's always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May the 8th, 2025. This is episode 3668 of the Survival Podcast, and I got a great lineup from the expert council for you today. As of 2 days ago, I wasn't sure we'd have an expert panel show today, but then I reached out to the expert council, and as usual, they came back in force. And so if you're a council member and you're listening to today's show and you're like, I'm not on there, and I made him, so many of y'all did it, I'm almost good for next week already. So that doesn't mean stop, guys and gals, but it does mean that we're in good shape. So I couldn't use everybody's that came in. I tried to pick some topical stuff, like from John Pugliano. I think that his segment is kind of time sensitive. Dr. Paul, his stuff we always lead off with when we have content from him, and we do. Chef Ken's got some good stuff. We haven't heard from him in a while. So same with Joel Riles. I tried to bring in some people that maybe we haven't heard from in a while. Nicole Saw. So here's what we do have today. Trump just announced yesterday a deal with the Houthis. Is that a win for the U.S. or not? Or was it actually proof that we couldn't do what we said we did? I actually differ with Dan McAdams' take on this. He and Dr. Paul a bit. I don't think you know yet. I think we'll find out. And when we find out, then we'll know. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about options for fish and seafood stews and soups. And when this came in, I was like, I think this is a series. I sent it to Ken. He goes, yeah. So he has three different ways that you can answer this question. But we're going to do one a week for a series on making seafood stews. Round one today, bouillabaisse, which is an amazing, amazing thing. Ken will tell you all about it. Matt Sersley is following up on something I said about how you can make money with a business even if you don't make money with a business. What the hell does that mean? Matt will explain it. John Pugliano is going to talk about Trump's madman strategy as it pertains to investing. And something just happened that shows that maybe John's right. Maybe it's working. Choosing a hand grinder for your coffee with Nicole Sauce. Hell, I should have one of these in T-Spaz because this is applied to me, and I will admit, I have gone out to the garage with my electric coffee grinder, plugged it into the generator, and started it just to grind coffee. That's another option, but it's not the only option here because what the person that wrote in said is they didn't want to break out the generator if it was going to be a short-term outage, but they also wanted coffee. So they thought like it'd be a good idea to just have a manual hand crank grinder. So Nicole has a couple recommendations on this. Joel Riles will talk about how to get cats and dogs to get along on the homestead. And this is something that a lot of times sooner or later happens itself, as long as the dog is not too aggressive initially, because the cat will correct the dog, is the upside of this, as long as it's controlled. And then we're going to talk about something I didn't know we needed to talk about. So I've been talking about Bitcoin a long time, and recently I did a post saying, hey, here's three resources for Bitcoin, one being Fold, one being apply for the new Fold credit card, which is different than the existing program. You got to get on a wait list for it, and one being using Strike. Well, somebody came back and said, I don't get Fold because I guess they looked at some marketing collateral or something. They only saw the bill pay option, which is a really, really low return. It really is, and it wouldn't be for everybody. But I'm like, but you can do all these other things and you can stack a ton of Bitcoin this way. And I've stacked like, you know, 12 million sats in the last couple of years with it. And like, you should be doing this because that's like, well, that's more than a tenth of a Bitcoin. And when I told him some of the things you could do, he was like, wow, I didn't see that. I didn't know that. So I'm going to go through just kind of like, if you're using the Fold app, how do you maximize getting the most amount of sats back without it really costing you any money other than maybe you're doing some Bitcoin buying, which you would do anyway. But I personally think the Fold card and the Fold app, along with Strike, are kind of the two easy buttons to get into stacking and to do both active stacking, which you do something like Strike for, where you do like a daily DCA, and passive stacking, which is where companies more and more now are starting to reward customers with points back in the form of Satoshis versus points that you can use to maybe do something someday, probably not, right? So I'm going to go over that today, and I think that will help a lot of people figure out, hey, you know, you could be stacking some Bitcoin. I'll just say it, you know. Even without spending money on Bitcoin, you could be stacking Bitcoin. And a lot of you, if I said, I'll give you a tenth of a Bitcoin, you'd get real excited about that, because as of today, that's about $10,000. It's about 10,000 bucks. Think about it. That's from passive stacking over about 2 years. And I'm not even fully maxing everything, because I'm playing with other programs and stuff as well. But this is, I think, the most approachable one. So I'll go over it today. And how you can really, like, if I did all my Amazon purchases the way I should through Fold using an Amazon gift card, that alone I would have more. So I need to follow my own advice when we get to that segment. Before we do, let me remind you again, guys, my book is coming out on Monday. Coming out on Monday. And I would love it if you would get by the site and fill out the simple form so I can email you on Monday when that book actually is live on Amazon with a link, and you can go ahead and pick it up. That would be great. And if you could pick up more than one copy and share one with somebody, that would be even better. Again, the ambassador programs are full, but there's something coming with this book. There's something coming with this book that you won't know until you get the book, but even if you don't have the book, I will tell you on Monday as well if you're on the announcement list. If you're not, you'll have to wait till you get your book. Isn't that cool? And then, no, you know what, Monday, you'll probably, there's another thing to this I'm just thinking of now in my head, and that will probably happen anyway. So you'll probably find out, but hey, get on the list, and you'll make sure that you know. And we're only using that list for the announcement. After that, any kind of email follow-ups and things like that, that will come by choice of opting into a different list. I'm literally going to take that email list sometime in the middle of next week, probably, after we've made sure that everybody on it's maybe had one or two emails saying, hey, the book's here. I'm just going to delete it. So you don't have to worry about getting a bunch of follow-up from just that. All it is hey, here's the book. Laws of Life, I poured my heart, my guts, and my soul into it. And I was about ready to go ahead and produce it right when COVID started almost 5 years ago, and I didn't. And it's always bothered me that I didn't. There was a bunch of reasons, and I don't want to make excuses, but there were some reasons why it got delayed, deferred, and then put off. And then, as I've been dealing with getting it ready to go and some of the things that are going to come with it, I realized I couldn't have done those back then. And now I can. And everything happens for a reason. I think this is the time for Laws of Life to be a thing, and I'd appreciate it if you pick up a copy and share it with others. With that, let's drop down in with Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams about the Houthi deal. Is it what Trump says? Is it what the Houthi said? What is it? Is it a win? Is it a loss? I don't know. Let's hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams.
Well, the other big news that we're watching is it was a kind of a surprise yesterday, and that's President Trump announcing that the U.S. would stop its airstrikes against Yemen. Now, these have gone on for a couple of months now, I think, if I'm not mistaken. They have caused a lot of destruction. They've caused a lot of civilian deaths in Yemen. Not a lot of military targets hit. In fact, they ran out of military targets. So the surprise announcement by Trump yesterday afternoon was, and apparently it was even more of a surprise to Netanyahu, who didn't know, because that's the reason we were bombing Yemen, to help Israel out. Now, this is antiwar.com's take on it. Trump says, U.S. will stop bombing Yemen. Now, here's how Trump put it. He said the U.S. will stop bombing Yemen, claiming the Houthis, officially known as Ansar Allah, said they would, quote, not be blowing up ships anymore. The president said the Houthis said, quote, they don't want to fight anymore, and we will honor that. We'll stop the bombings. They have capitulated. We'll take their word for that they'll stop blowing up ships anymore, and that's the purpose of what we're doing. Well, so Trump, of course, is framing it in a way that makes him look like he defeated the Houthis, which is not the case. But nevertheless, I think welcome. If he needs to have that little boost that he did it, that's fine, because as long as the bombing stops. But here's an interesting exchange, if we can put that first video clip on, because someone, one of the reporters asked him in the Oval Office, well, who told you that they begged you to stop, you know, to stop bombing them? And let's just put that one on and have a, this is a quick one. So let's just listen and hear what they said.
Tell us a bit more about the deal that you've reached with the Houthis.
No, it's not a deal. They've said, please don't bomb us anymore, and we're not going to attack your ships.
And where did you hear about that?
It doesn't matter where I hear it. A very, very good source.
So where did you hear about this? It doesn't matter where I heard about it. It kind of sounds like he's making it up. You know, he wants to sound like he made him back down. And again, if that's the case, that's fine. But actually, on their side, the quotes, if you go to the next clip, on their side, Mohammed al-Bukhati, member of Ansar Allah's political bureau, the Houthi political bureau, said in a statement after Trump's announcement that they will stop attacks on U.S. assets in the region if the U.S. stops bombing Yemen, but vowed operations against Israel will continue until there's a ceasefire and an end ceasefire in Gaza and end to the blockade of Palestinian territory. So here is the Yemeni official. He said, our military operations in support of Gaza will not cease until the aggression against Gaza stops, the blockade on its residents is lifted, allowing the entry of food, medicine, and fuel. As for our attacks on the U.S., they fall within the context of the right to self-defense. If it halts its attacks on us, we will halt our attacks on it. This position also applies to Britain. So that's their take on it. Stop bombing us, we'll stop bombing you. Sounds like a fair deal.
You know, it goes back and forth, and Trump was sort of caught in this. But I had written myself a note going over this stuff, and I thought, what Trump does is he puts words into the mouths of his opposition.
Yeah, yeah.
He implies he might not be swearing under oath that he said it, but he comes up with these statements that, you know, imply a whole lot, and then all of a sudden we find an alternative and there's an explanation for this.
Yeah, I think this is, I think, of more importance than people may realize. Because what it really signifies in the message, it doesn't matter if Americans don't get it or if the propaganda or if Trump's explanation works on people and makes them think that we had a victory. But the fact of the matter is it shows that with all the strength of U.S. carrier groups, with all of the advanced weapons, with a $1 trillion military budget, the United States was not able to defend, was not able to defeat the Houthis in Yemen. And that's just a fact that the rest of the world will see. As Yemen said, the siege of Gaza is not appropriate under the responsibility to protect guidelines. They feel they have an obligation to defend these people, these civilians who are being starved to death and bombed to death by Israel. And that's the reason they started, and the U.S. went in to backstop Israel and lost and had to pull back.
Now, here's where I disagree with this, and I'll tell you why I think the disagreement even exists, because I think Dr. Paul and Dan are both smart enough people that what I'm going to say is probably what they would have said if this was about any area other than the Middle East. I think there are people that are so opposed to United States actions in the Middle East, and I think both, I love them both, I'm not a criticist, I'm just saying we all have things that we can become attached to and biased to and things like that. They're so opposed to what Israel does, they're so opposed to what we do in conjunction with Israel, and they're so opposed to the overall Middle East policies that we have, which I have massive amounts of condemnation for myself, but they are so negative on it that as soon as it's attached to anything, it becomes you have to take the other side, and it becomes reactionary. And I feel like that's what's happening here. And when I explain my position, maybe it'll make sense, especially if you're in, and I'm doing it mainly for people that are in that same boat. All right, so Trump said, we will stop bombing you if you stop attacking U.S. shipping vessels. Okay, that's what he said, all right? That's what he said the deal is based on. Now, were the Houthis attacking ships other than Israeli ships before we started bombing them? The answer is yes. Okay? So, there is a deal to be made there outside of just Israel. First of all, right? Trump said, don't worry about it, I got it from a very good source. Well, does that mean he's lying or whatever? Well, here's the thing about Trump. He says shit like that all the time, even when he's not lying. The real answer is, maybe I don't want you to know how this deal was made. And there's a lot of shit that gets done at high levels of government where things like this happen that you don't want to reveal, you know, what they always say when they ask them for Freedom of Information Act stuff, sources and methods. Well, in this case, there might actually be some legitimate sources and methods that you just don't need to know about, and you ask the guy a question, he didn't have a prepared statement, don't worry about it. That's Trump. That's Trump in a nutshell, even when he's telling the complete truth. The way you'll know how this is going to play out is if they don't shoot any more shit at U.S. or other vessels, then you know Trump told you the truth and that the Houthis kept their word. If they immediately begin attacking other vessels, then you know that Trump either lied or the Houthis, and we still don't know, but at least that is, to me, this is a fair evaluation of the situation. Now, does that mean vessels under Israeli flags will be attacked? I don't know. If they are, does that mean the U.S. will not defend them? I doubt it. Will our defense be seen as attack? I don't know. All this needs to play out. But I don't think you can always just say, because a president tells you, don't worry about it, this is a legit source, that doesn't necessarily mean they're lying. Now, I personally think most politicians are lying when their mouth opens. But I've said this before about Trump. For all the things that I do not like that he's done, for all the things that I can criticize him for, and boy, howdy, can I, he's the best president this country's had in my lifetime, and I remember Jimmy freaking Carter. And he's not the best from a pontification, how he talks. He seems erratic. I'm talking about the results gained by the actions taken. I've never seen anything as positive for the country up till now. It could all go south than what he's doing. And I think that we maybe need to give a little bit of breathing room here. And I'll say this, too, about the Middle East. I said this today on X. It is absolutely a freedom of speech thing to say something negative about Israel and criticize Israel and criticize Israel's actions, including in Gaza. That's all under freedom of speech. Now, is it still freedom of speech? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. When you start saying things like from the river to the sea, which literally is a chant that means to exterminate all Jewish people out of Israel and kill them. That is a different thing. That's anti-Semitic. Whether it's free speech or not, we can debate, but that's anti-Semitic, okay? That's anti-Jew. That is not in the same as these things that Israel's doing are completely wrong and should be opposed. Now, if you take that and you add to it this need to defend everything that's anti-Trump and everything that's anti-Israel, and you say, how does that apply to a student here on a student visa? I'm sorry, fucking no. Do you have a right to free speech as a foreign student in the United States? You sure do. You have a right. You're not going to get arrested for it. You're not going to get shot for it. You're not going to get shit beat out of you for it. But do you have a right to the visa in the first place? Absolutely fucking not. You do not. A visa to become a student long-term in another nation, a foreign nation other than your own, including for us going to other nations, if we are a U.S. student, let's say in Spain, or let's say in Russia, or let's say in the UK, is a privilege. The end. I'm sorry. It is. So you can have free speech. It doesn't mean you get free access to a visa, and it doesn't mean that exercising your free speech in a foolish way, like one of these clowns they're going to throw out, has literally said, our purpose is to overthrow the U.S. government. Okay, you don't, unless you're suicidal and idiotic as a country, you don't let that person, in this case happens to be from the Mideast, I don't care where they're from. You don't let that person into your country on a student visa. And if you accidentally do because you didn't know, when that person shows you who they are, you throw them the fuck out. These things are all compartmentalized. They are not all mixed together. And there seems to be an excessive desire right now to mix them together. That's my take on it. Let's move on to other things. That'll be all the politics for today. We're going to talk about making bouillabaisse, which is a lot more exciting to me, with Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Jerry. He writes, I've got frozen seafood from Costco. You know, shrimp, scallops, whitefish. And I want to make a seafood soup that's low carb and not rubbery. I've tried starting with clam chowder, but everything turns tough. I don't want gumbo heat either. Jerry, I hear you. What you're describing isn't chowder. It isn't gumbo. What you're craving is bouillabaisse, even if you didn't know it. So, what the hell is bouillabaisse? Listen, I know Frenchy-sounding words can make people feel too fancy, but we've got to get over that. Bouillabaisse comes from Marseille, France, and it was born from what fishermen couldn't sell, like fish head, bones, scraps, things that wouldn't move on the market, or fish that no one wanted, like scorpionfish or eel. They boiled it, then reduced it. And that's actually where the name comes from. Bouillir means to boil, bassar means to lower. So bouillabaisse, to boil and then lower the heat. For me, there's no finer fish dish for a true homesteader. It actually used to be called the poor man's fish stew. And the classic version does take hours to make, and for a chef like me, it's an all-day labor of love. It's whole fish, rouille, croutons, saffron threads. Delicious? Hell yes. Realistic for a weekend? Hell no. So we're going to do it my way. Fast, elegant, freezer-friendly, and dialed in for texture and flavor. So we got to start with the right foundation. Let's begin with aromatics, and this matters. Instead of starting with olive oil, like most recipes, I go with butter. It gives it a rounder, smoother base for the leeks and fennel. There's no sharp, grassy notes, just soft depth. Into that butter goes fennel bulb, leeks, shallots, and garlic. Low heat, slow sweat. You want everything to be soft and sweet, no browning. This dish calls for a bit of patience, but I promise you, you'll be rewarded. Once that's soft, add a spoonful of tomato paste and let it cook for a minute. Then hit it with a good splash of dry white wine or a spirit called Pernod and scrape the bottom bits off the pan. Seriously, Pernod, it's cheap and usually found in most liquor stores. There are several must-use ingredients if you want this classic dish to come alive, and this is one of them. So whatever amount of liquid is in your pan at this point, just reduce it by half. So here's a chef move I swear by. If you've got shrimp shells from your frozen shrimp, toss them in now. They'll deepen the broth and add this like oceany backbone that frozen fish fillets alone can't deliver. Not the shrimp, just the shells. Then we're going to add some broth. Fish stock, if you've got it, is great, but let's be honest, very few of you have fish stock lying around, so just use water. More non-negotiable items that you must add: bay leaf, some thyme, and saffron. Go to T-Spaz, but buy the smallest amount you can find of saffron. It's usually like 10 bucks for like 1 gram. It will last forever. You only need a pinch, but don't even think about skipping it. This is the soul of the dish, and it's what makes bouillabaisse bouillabaisse. Okay, so we're going to simmer it gently for about 25-30 minutes, lid slightly cracked, just enough to keep the flavors tight. You're not boiling the hell out of this, you're just melding the flavor. Then I do something that most chefs won't tell you. I blend and strain. I take an immersion blender and I blitz the hell out of it. And then I strain it through a fine mesh strainer with some cheesecloth. I use a spatula and press all the liquid out until it's a paste. And what you're left with is this deep golden broth that tastes like sea and smells like you know what the hell you're doing. Side note, I've always wanted to take this paste and freeze dry it. I bet it would make a really great base powder for stock. Let me know if you try this and if it works. Okay, so this is where most people screw this up. Timing is everything if you don't want things to get tough and rubbery. You can use frozen Costco seafood. Just make sure it's fully thawed and patted dry. If it's still icy, it'll dilute the broth, kill the temperature, and make everything just taste like failure. We're going to use the technique poaching again. If you've listened before, think of poaching like a warm bath for cooking. This time we're going to be taking seafood though and bathing it in its own juices. The poaching order matters, so think about firmness. Mussels or clams, if you got them, go in first. They need time to open up. Next is your firm fish, like cod, halibut, red snapper. You'll know when it's done, when it's firm but not falling apart. Then you're going to throw in things like scallops if you've got them. Again, you're looking for firmness, not pencil eraser. Less is more. And last, shrimp. It only takes about 90 seconds to cook these things. A shrimp is cooked when it's pink and a C shape. Overcooked look like they're the letter O. Your broth should be hot and simmering at most. You're not boiling. This is a spa day, not a pressure cook. Poach gently. Your seafood will come perfectly cooked and soft, opaque, and juicy. Pro tip, use a wide, shallow pot if you can. It helps the seafood cook evenly and lets the broth reduce without going murky. Spoon the liquid over the seafood when you poach. And we're going to finish this like a true chef. Now, this comes the final 2%. The part that separates pretty good to damn, that's restaurant quality stuff. Once your seafood is poached, turn the heat off and just let the pot rest. Let the protein settle and soak up a little of that broth. And then you're going to hit it with just a little grated olive oil, a squeeze of lemon if you like, but my secret ingredient is add a little bit of fresh orange zest. Don't cook the zest. The oils will burn off. You just want that high citrusy aroma to kind of hit you right before you spoon it into your mouth. Oh, and yeah, this stuff freezes really well. So just the broth, so not the seafood. Make it a couple times a year, and when you're craving, you've got some already made. This is low carb and intensely flavorful. Now, this is where I would recommend toasting a baguette, make some saffron aioli, and let the toast soak up the delicious broth. Looking for keto style? Skip the toast, dollop it straight into the broth. That richness and acidity combo, it's a game changer. Jerry, there you go, bouillabaisse. Do not feel intimidated. Yes, there are some different techniques and different ingredients that you may have not used before, but once you learn this dish, you'll understand why it's one of the best dishes in the world. You'll find these recipes and a ton more keto carnivore recipes at bloodsugarchef.com. Keep those questions coming in. Until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So as I said that in my intro, that's a first segment in this series, and there's at least two more. I primed that pump a little bit with some ideas, but he came back with some better ideas than even what I had. And I'm excited about this series. I love to cook. You guys know that. And I love to make things like soups and stews. and I love to do things with seafood. So this is all in my wheelhouse. Let's start out next, or let's move on and go next to Matt Sersley, the Agoras tax attorney. And from him, we are going to hear about how you can have a business that makes money that doesn't make money. It sounds like an idiom or redundant, some kind of redundant idiocracy or something, but it's not. And he is referring to comments I've made to that effect, and I think it'll make sense after you hear him.
Hey, TSP, this is Matthew Sersley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com, coming to talk with you about some more tax tips. On a recent episode, Jack was talking about how you can make no money in your business but still come out ahead because of the taxes. How does that work? Well, let's say you start a job working for Uber. Let's say you make $1,000 a month every month for the next year, so $12,000. But you're going to have expenses. Now, some of those are going to be expenses directly related for the business. You're going to write off, you know, the mileage for the driving you do, and that's going to reduce your income by something. Let's say that drops it down to $600 a month. Well, but if you spend that money on other things that are business expenses, but are more personal expenses, you come out ahead. So the low-hanging fruit are things like you should absolutely be paying for a lot of, or maybe even entirely, your whole cell phone bill if you are doing Uber, because you need to use your cell phone for Uber. Well, that's a business expense. Instead of doing mileage, you might actually do a percentage of the actual real cost of the car. That would include depreciation of the car. That would include insurance. That would include gas. That would include maintenance. Well, you're also in business. Maybe you need a new computer. Buy that computer for your business. Use it for the business. Yeah, even as an Uber, you need a computer, if nothing else, to do the paperwork, to do your taxes for the business. But now you have a computer. Similarly, you can pay for software for that computer, whether it's a one-time fee or an ongoing license. Though that software, if you use it for your business, is all of a business expense. And finally, let's say now you're down to, you made $3,000 instead of that, you know, $12,000. Well, let's say you want to go to Las Vegas. And so you find some sort of a conference in Las Vegas that's appropriate. And I've looked it up. There are conferences on how to make more money as a rideshare driver in Vegas, multiple of them in the next 3 months. So you go to that conference in Las Vegas. Now your airfare is tax deductible. Your hotel is tax deductible. Half of the meals, or half of what you pay on the meals, are tax deductible. Oh, and if you don't spend much on meals, you can actually use the per diem instead of what you actually paid. So if you want to be cheap and, you know, make all the food yourself in your hotel room, you still get a deduction for the cost of what those meals should have been. And now that vacation, and of course it is a vacation to Las Vegas, is now also tax deductible. And in this way, you made no income, you owe no taxes, but you're obviously better off. You took, you know, $5,000, $6,000, maybe $7,000 of expenses that you had that were money you were paying out of pocket after tax, and now you're paying it before tax. This is why, as Jack has talked about so often, as I've talked about so often, one of the best things you can do to get ahead financially is to start a business, to run a real business, and to figure out how taxes work, because it's really, really easy to make a business making $500 or $1,000 a month, again, doing something like Uber or DoorDash or something like that. And you can use that to pay for things that you're already paying for before tax and come out way ahead. If you're in the, you know, combined 25% state and federal tax bracket and you've made that $12,000, that's like making $15,000 from your day job instead. It adds up really, really quickly. Well, hey, for this and other tax advice, please reach out to me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. That'll get you a free download on a whole lot of things you can deduct from your business to get your mind flowing. And you'll get an email to set up a free phone call with me to see if I can help you out more. Thanks so much.
So Uber, DoorDash, all of that is a great side hustle business, because it's almost better than a business in a box, because it doesn't cost much to get started, and all you need is a vehicle. Now, if you're going to do Uber or Lyft where you're driving people, you have to have a background check that you have to pay for. That's tax deductible, by the way. And you also have to have a vehicle of a certain make, model, and age and mileage on it. Where if you're doing DoorDash, they don't really give a shit if you're driving a jalopy when you deliver somebody's order from a barbecue joint or something like that. It all makes sense. Either way, though, do you know what the mileage deduction is? 70 cents a mile. So if you are a dedicated Uber driver, like an Uber Black, and you're driving like an Escalade or something for that quality of service, and that's pretty much your full-time gig, then he's right. It may benefit you to depreciate the vehicle and take all the maintenance and costs of the vehicle versus the mileage. But if you're not 100% dedicated with your vehicle, it's not for that purpose. You need different insurances, by the way, when you do that. If you are only part-time with it and that vehicle is your personal vehicle as well, it's almost 100% that you would be better off and much safer with the mileage deduction. That's all I'll say about that, because that's $70 per 100 miles driven. And this is why the government freaking hates Uber and Lyft. Now, your local governments hate it because you're cutting into their DUI money, but that ship sailed long enough ago they've pretty much given up on it, and they hate it because you're cutting into, like, some of the places, their revenue that they get from taxi cab medallions and stuff like that, i.e. New York City and Las Vegas. But pretty much the people that hate it the most is the federal government and the state governments from states that have income tax. Like, the Texas doesn't have a state income tax, so they don't give a shit about it from that perspective, but a lot of states have fairly high individual and company income tax rates. Because of that, they don't like this, because almost none of the Uber or Lyft drivers actually make a profit, or they make a very tiny profit that doesn't really help the state or the government, the federal government out much with tax side of things. And more importantly, and this is where this all folds together, these are what we would call phantom deductions. Now, the government made the rules mostly for themselves and their cronies, but we get to use them. I always say 90% of the tax code is how you get out of doing what 10% of the tax code says you have to do. And you want to focus on the 90, not the 10 here. And so this is all great advice. But let's stack it with one of Matt's earlier segments. A couple weeks ago, Matt did a segment on why you want a home office. Now let's take what we learned in that segment and put it with this segment. What Matt said accurately, if I have a home office, when I leave my home office to go somewhere, that initial mileage drop is deductible. If I'm an Uber driver without a home office, including if it's a tiny little space dedicated in my apartment that's just for my business, then I hate money. Because you could get that call while you're sitting at home, you turn your app on, and you have to drive 25 miles. Right? What is that? That's like, it's about $18 of deduction you don't get. But where you could have the, you see where I'm getting at here. So now you have the home ops deduction, plus you have the, they call it the meter drop in the taxi cab world. When you get that first call and you go out, and then everything you do until you come back to your office and then commute to home by walking from one corner of your apartment to the other, that all stacks together. And there's a lot of things like that in businesses that are phantom losses. So my home office deduction, as I've talked about, because we have a big house and it's fairly expensive, and we have two dedicated offices, mine and my wife's, and they are 100% dedicated. You send an IRS agent here anytime, I'd be like, well, you're a disorganized, messy asshole, but I can see that this place only serves as your office. That is a big deduction, and we're backfeeding things like homeowners insurance, right? Now, if the SALT stuff changes in the new tax bill, this may change, but as of right now, we're backfeeding every single expense connected to the house into that. We have to pay for that anyway. If I did not own a business, I don't know what this room would be, but it would still be here. It just happens to be my office because I have a business. So my cost is the same. My expenses are therefore what we would refer to as a phantom expense. In other words, it's an expense that's not really realized, or an expense that would exist anyway. And there's a lot of that, and it is a good part of picking apart the tax code. Now, remember, the IRS, I don't remember if it's every 4 years or 5 years or 3 years, There's a certain amount you have to make a profit with a business or it becomes a hobby. When it's a hobby, what sucks about it is you have to report all the revenue in and you don't get to deduct any of the expenses out. So as Matt's also formally advised you, if that's you, if you can always declare a loss, you know, then you're probably actually making money or you wouldn't keep doing it. You can always just hedge your expenses, you know, 1 year out of three and show a small profit of, you know, even $1,000, something significant. The actual tax on that is compared to all of the other advantages. If you worry about that, oh, I'm going to have to pay them an extra $200 this year, but you save $20,000 over the last 4 years, you're tripping over dimes on the, in fact, you're tripping over pennies on the way to dollars, and you hate money, so don't do that. All right, moving on. I did not go that long edition. That's just a great segment by Matt. Let's talk about Trump and his madman policy. That's the words of John Pugliano. That is not the term I would have used, but it's a perfect term, and why it might actually be working and continue to work.
Hello, TSP. Well, hey, I want to give you a quick update on the stock market. I'm getting a lot of questions from people that are wondering if the bottom that we saw on April 7th is actually the low for this year and if, you know, the worst is over. And there's a lot of people that are pointing to different indicators. But as I've been saying for most of the year, this market isn't driven by technicals. It isn't driven by fundamentals. It's simply driven by whatever comes out of President Trump's mouth. And from day to day or minute to minute, you don't know what that's going to be. Now, personally, while I wouldn't conduct business that way if I were president, fact of the matter is I'm not president. And that's the way he chooses to do things. And in reality, it's actually working quite well. He's using a madman strategy as a negotiation tool, and I think it's going to prove to be very effective. In particular, pay attention to what he's doing with Canada. You know, he's been taunting the Canadians about being the 51st state, but I think that's all just a magician's illusion. You know, while everybody's looking at the right hand, the magician is actually performing the trick with the left. And in terms of Trump's antagonism towards Canada, where I think you want to look is not north of the border, but rather south of the border. Going forward, as you've heard me say many times, from both a national security standpoint and an economic standpoint, I think the strength and the resilience in the global economy is going to be focused around North America. And that means a strong partnership between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. But where the real economic integration is going to take place, I believe, is in Mexico. That may not be politically correct for Trump to say, especially with some in his supporter base. And so while he talks about bringing Canada in as the 51st state, I think it's more likely to be Mexico, and not necessarily as a state, but certainly our economic integration is going to be far greater with Mexico than it will be with Canada going forward. Mexico provides not only low-cost labor, but also a very young working demographic and much lower and lax environmental standards for a lot of the dirty refining and processing work that we're going to have moved out of China and into North America for national security reasons. This economic integration isn't lost on the Mexicans either. You know, on Liberation Day, the Canadians came out double barrels with retaliatory tariffs, while the Mexican President Sheinbaum did exactly the opposite. Yes, she had talked tough early on about tariffs and retaliation and opposition to the Gulf of Mexico having a name change. But by the time the rubber really met the road on April 2nd, when Trump announced the tariffs, he went very light on Mexico, and she specifically said Mexico would not retaliate at this time. So keep your eye on Mexico rather than Canada. Ignore what's happening in the news, ignore the media, ignore what Trump says. Watch what's actually happening, and I particularly think over the coming weeks and months, we could see some clarity on the tariff policy, because ultimately I think the whole reason this has come up is to specifically target the Chinese Communist Party, and we're doing this not for economic reasons, but for national security reasons. I think we're also likely to get a Fed interest rate cut later on in the summer. And certainly by midsummer or even earlier, we might get some resolution on the budget and what's going on with tax policy. All those could be good for the economy. And what I'm most interested in is how much more deregulation we're going to see, because we are seeing immense deregulation, whether it's in terms of the SEC, the banking laws, or even the Environmental Protection Agency. And I think more so than anything, deregulation could have the biggest impact on growing the economy. And regardless of what Trump says or does, it's to his best interest that we go into 2026, the midterm election, with a very strong and healthy and robust U.S. economy. Wait, just my thoughts. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Standing Podcast.
So I usually have some alternate take on what John Pugliano says. Like, I agree 90%, here's the 10% I disagree with. Not this time, 100%. That is exactly what I think is going on. John and I talked about some other stuff, Canada-Greenland related, while we were up in Tennessee together, and I think we were completely in sync on that as well. I think that if you have derangement syndrome or you just hate Trump, it's hard for you to see what's going on. Okay, and if you are just something I've struggled with, just completely negative toward almost all of this shit anyway, it's hard to see. The only reason I can see it is because I make myself, because to do this job, I feel like I have to be an impartial judge of what's happening apart from my feelings to the people. The stuff about Mexico, I completely agree with. And here's how this plays out at an even bigger level. Okay, Mexico, here's what we're going to do. You're going to have this new plant being built down there by this company, and you're going to make these parts that are actually going to go to a place in Tennessee or Texas or Alabama to be assembled. On those things, we're going to tariff you 20%. Hold the fuck on. Don't worry about it. What do you mean don't worry? Well, your cost of labor is so much lower than Canada. Okay, to make, let's say, a motor for Toyota or a Chevy, right, or a Ford, your cost of labor is so much lower that even with a 20% tariff, the manufacturers that want you to build the parts have already agreed that they'll price the tariff in. Well, now you have revenue from the product coming in. You actually have U.S. jobs at the assembly portion, and you still have a lower cost, so everybody wins. And there is a lot of things that we either cannot build cost-effectively in the United States or within the framework of regulatory bodies, and not all of them are simple to remove. Not all of them can be done with an EO, and the truth is that a corporation is not going to build a facility based on an EO because the next guy can just sign a new EO and destroy all your investment. So they need some further assurances. So I guarantee you there's discussions going on like this that aren't about these foreign governments. Directly or indirectly, it's, you know, CEOs, chief operating officers as well, that are coming to the Trump administration. And trust me, when you run a multi-billion dollar corporation and you currently are doing business overseas and domestically and you want to talk to Trump, you may not talk to Trump, but you're going to talk to one of his people. They will talk to you. They'll take that meeting. And what they're saying is things like, we can't build these pieces in the United States, and here's why. And if you tell us how we can, from a standpoint of regulation and affordability, we'll do it. And there's going to be some of those things that those personnel look at. And Trump's people are business people. They understand this. They're not retards like most politicians have when it comes to business anyway. Okay, not necessarily foreign policy, but business. And they're going to say, you know what, you're right. I understand from a numbers perspective or from a regulatory framework, these things do not work. Where do they work? And almost all of them, unless they're super high technical, because the technical expertise have not been built down there yet, will work in Mexico. Okay? So whether it's refining things that we cannot refine in this country due to environmental regulation, or it's just a straight-up cost. In other words, yeah, we can pay Americans to bolt the truck together, but not to build the framework of the engine, or whatever it is. Then they'll make those deals with Mexico, and some of those deals may even incur, like I said, a significant tariff. Let's say the base tariff rate with Mexico goes down to like 10%. Some of these special exceptions might be a 20% tariff, but Mexico won't care. And the reason Mexico won't care is basically you have Ford saying, we'll buy all of widget X from you at this agreed upon price, including the tariff. Well, you don't care anymore. It's not like we'll buy more if you cut the price or cut the tariff. Like, Ford will be able to say, we need to build X amount of F-150s and we need Y amount of widgets to build those, and we don't want to do it. So here's what we can afford, Does it work for you with this adder? And when they say yes, again, no one gives a shit. No one cares. It doesn't matter anymore. And I know some of you are like, but it's theft. I understand that. But the people making these deals don't give a fuck. They don't care. They care about, does it function? Does it work? Does it give us what we want? And I think you're going to see an incredible partnership going forward with Mexico. And the truth is, the best thing we could do for ourselves is help the Mexicans develop Mexico to where if you're a Mexican citizen, you feel like I have a future here, so that everybody in Mexico stops trying to bail out of Mexico and come here. Now, they got to fix their cartel problems, too. That's a different issue. But overall, most of the reason Mexicans come to America today is not because of cartels. It's because they don't feel like they can make enough money to support their family. So if their nation can develop on this in a way that partners with America versus competes with America, we end up in a much better stabilized situation, and you also have something else happen. Hey, you guys like it now? Oh, yeah, we like it. We like it this way. Okay, great. We need you to make sure no more of these freaking caravans of shit coming up out of the freaking Panama and Central America and all these people coming in like from Jamaica getting into your country, march to our border and get in anymore. Yes, we shut the border down, but we need your help too so that it's less work for all of us. And if you want that, then this is what we need. I'm telling you, conversations like that are happening back door right now. And Trump just laid the smack down on Carney, by the way. Basically, had him, it was like a Zelensky moment, but nicer. He's like, but we don't want to buy trucks from Canada. We don't want to buy steel from Canada. He's saying this right in front of Carney. We don't want to buy aluminum from Canada because we want to make it ourselves. Yeah, but we can't make it all ourselves. But what is going to be less expensive, Mexico with a 20% tariff or Canada with zero? You know the answer to anything Mexico can do and what Mexico can't do, we probably want to do in America. This is actually a brilliant plan if it's executed, you know, 90% of what's planned. And on that note, as this is happening, Trump announced they have a deal with the UK. All that bullshit talk out of Keir Starmer about, we're going to do this, and we're going to kiss the American ass, because in the end, the American market is more important to the UK than the UK market is to America. He's being a bully, and you can hate that, but he's being a bully because we are the strongest fighter in the group. The only people that can stand against us at all, even close, are China, and now they're isolated. Could this be the golden age? I do believe it can. And I'm the guy that's been like, this is all going to crash. It still will sooner or later. We can't do this forever. The only hope I see, I won't get into today because you don't need any more about Bitcoin than I'm going to say at the end. But even that is a gamble at this point because we've caused so much trouble with this fiat bullshit. It doesn't mean you can't restart the ban for another decade or three. Who knows? Anyway, let's move on and let's talk about coffee with Nicole Sauce.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee here with a question about hand grinders. Aaron recently had a power outage and realized that they were not really up for popping up the generator until they knew it was going to be a longer outage, and all of their coffee was in bean format, and that was sad because they couldn't have a cup of coffee. And I agree, it's really sad when you want a nice hot cup of coffee in an ice storm and your power's out and you can't grind your coffee and then you're in trouble, right? Well, you don't have to be. There's a couple of things. One, yes, you can get a hand grinder and use that. If you're looking for a hand grinder and you want to get a new one, what I recommend is look for a hand burr grinder. They tend to be all metal in the parts that grind the coffee. I've included two links, one with plastic packaging, one with stainless steel. And neither one of them have I tried because every time I settle on and test a hand burr grinder from a source, they exist for about a year and then they go into a different, they either rebrand or they go somewhere else. But I can say this, for the purposes you're looking for, these burr grinders do a great job. They last a year or two if you're using them every day, and then you're going to end up getting another one. An alternative is to go to antique stores and see what they have on hand. You can find some antique hand grinders to use. Those work perfectly well. Here's the thing. Getting too snobby about how your coffee is ground when you're in a power outage situation Seems like a bad idea. And that leads me to one other option you can take, which is to buy freeze-dried coffee. Does Hollow Roast make freeze-dried coffee? No. But you can get some decent ones. Black Rifle makes one that's not bad. I use that when I'm hiking so that I don't have to bring coffee grounds in and bring coffee grounds out. And they aren't that expensive. And if you're only out of power, you know, a day or five a year, you might just get like a 10 pack of those. They last forever. It's easy to use them. But if you really want a hand grinder, those two from Amazon or an antique store is a great way to go. The final way you could address this is just to keep a quarter pound of coffee in your freezer ground and it'll be stale. But life goes on. If you're going to do that, make sure you package it in a way that it does not absorb other freezer flavors. Those are all my ideas for handling a power outage and not having your grinder. I hope you found this segment helpful. If you do want to get awesome coffee and be a coffee snob without having to run all over your county looking for freshly roasted coffee, I know a lady who can hook you up. You can check out our single origin coffees and other coffee blends at hollowroast.com. We've even got a subscription option for you. And if you travel to hotels a lot and want K-cups, we do have some of the freshest K-cups available because we are not going through the grocery store distribution network, which means they're not sitting around in a warehouse. Once we get low on K-cups, we produce more K-cups, and that's how that cycle works. Check it out, hollowroast.com. If you are MSB, you get a discount. Be sure to use it. Make it a great week, guys.
So one little add-on, and it's now standard procedure here that I do this. Everybody loves to grind the coffee right before you make it, but a day, half a day even, is no big deal. So when I'm kind of like, we've made our last coffees of the day, I put enough through the grinder and put it in a little cup that I keep with my coffee making stuff that I can make at least one batch the next morning. That way if the power goes off and I wake up, and I don't have to do anything except turn the kettle on the gas stove, and I've got enough coffee to make that first round of coffee to get, you know, that pickup start of the day, and then you get on to your regular, you know, figuring out what to do about the power being out, get your blackout kit and all. By the way, I was recently talking to somebody, and I think I agree with their suggestion. They said, you know, it's been a long time since you've done some prepper basics, and their suggestion was, because they said they've used it more than anything else I've recommended over the years, not a generator, though they've used that too, a blackout kit. A blackout kit is the stuff that when your power goes out, it's all in one kit, and it gets you, if generator is part of your plan, it gets you to the point where the generator's running. You know, it's all the things that you need when, you know, the power goes out and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's what you can see. What happens when the power goes out at 9:30, your one kid's in the bathtub, right? But they're old enough to not have to be supervised, so you've left. Dad's taking a shower. Mom's in the kitchen. The other kid's upstairs in their room, and now it's dark. And crying starts, and yelling starts, and blackout kit is how you deal with that. So maybe we'll do a show on blackout kits, or a BOC as I call it, next week. If you'd like that, let me know. Comment in the episode or send me an email or something like that. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and we got one more before we have my segment on Bitcoin and Fold. Getting cats and dogs to get along. You know, now I've always talked about, you know, someday maybe it'll rain cats and dogs and they'll have puppy kittens, and just as a joke. But getting cats and dogs to get along is a big issue for a lot of people, because a lot of people that are dog owners are also cat owners, especially homesteaders, because cats do some things that dogs don't, like, you know, decapitate rats just for fun. And they tend to be better at it than dogs, in my opinion, because they have more patience in setting up an ambush. So that means you're going to end up at a point where, you know, doggy and kitty might have some conflicting things going on. So what do we do about that? Here's Joel Riles to talk about it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy, coming back at you for another expert counsel segment. And today's question comes from Jason Elliott. If you guys have not seen his whiskey smokers, they are pretty awesome. You should check them out. But his question is about integrating a dog with a cat in the home. So they have a foster dog, and he's thinking that it could probably be a good enough dog for them to keep forever, but he's slightly concerned about the interactions between the dog and the cat and wanted to know if I had any advice about it. So whenever you're integrating a new dog into your household, whether you have other dogs or cats, here's how I generally recommend doing that. Specifically with cats, I like to bring the dog into the house and put them into a down stay, typically next to a couch or something so I can sit next to them. And then I watch and wait for the cat to come and interact with the dog. Now, sometimes this will take a couple of days or a week for the cat to get comfortable enough to come over and interact with the dog. Sometimes the cats will come out and start to do this right away. So if the cat's not really interacting, then I just work my obedience with the dog and work them being good in the house, right? But then I'm keeping my eyes open for when the cat comes out and starts to engage with the dog. I want to sit next to the dog. I have their lead in my hand, and I'm sitting beside them, and I just tell them, leave it alone. It's okay. Usually they're really interested in the cat. They're kind of watching the cat as it approaches. And then as the cat gets closer, I just tell the dog, leave it. It's okay. As long as they're laying down, they're being calm, I'll pet them on the head. And when the cat comes up, I'm not putting tension on the lead, right? Because that actually will build anxiety in the dog to do something. I'm just sitting there beside the dog, lead in my hand. It's loose. It's not tight on their collar. But if they go to lunge to the cat or anything like that, I can correct. Now, there's two things that are going to happen if there's any kind of interaction that you need to fix. One is if the dog moves, I can correct the dog. The other one is if your cat still has its claws, the cat can actually claw at the dog. And you can tell how serious the cat is based on whether they swat the dog with their claws in or whether they swat the dog with their claws out and give them a scratch on the face. So sometimes that's enough for the dogs to go, okay, don't mess with the cat. I don't want to get scratched again. But in general, what I want the dog to learn is lay there, be calm, pretty much ignore the cat. I have a Dutch Shepherd Striker. He's upstairs right now in the house with the family. He's obsessed with the cats. He loves them, and he just wants to sniff them and lay next to them. And then sometimes it gets annoying to them, and they're like, hey, go away, leave me alone, and they'll swat at him. But almost never do they actually do it with their claws out. And so that's how I do that interaction with a cat. That can take multiple segments of that, right? 4 or 5 times sometimes to get the dog to actually lay there and chill out while the cat's walking around them and doing stuff. Once the cat realizes you're not going to let the dog do anything, typically the cat will get a little braver and they'll come around the dog more often. So usually after the first or second time, then the cats will come around more frequently. I just keep an eye on the dog, leave it alone, it's okay. If I'm working with other dogs, what I like to do is bring both the dogs into the room, but I typically will put one over on one side of the room and the other on the other side of the room, 10, 15 feet apart from each other, have them both lay down, and then I just let them get used to the other dog being in the room. If one dog growls or their hackles raise, I go correct the dog, tell them, fooey that, leave it alone, it's okay. And I just have them lay there until they're both comfortable. And then I'll either, step by step, move them closer together, right? And again, this is a multi-day, multi-event situation. This isn't all in one night. But I'll move them a little closer the next time, a little closer the next time. If what often happens, though, what usually happens, is at some point in the evening, they'll kind of start creeping. Now, I don't normally allow my dogs to creep, but when I'm doing this particular type of integration, I let them creep together and I keep an eye on them. Typically, they'll get close enough that they'll start to kind of play a little bit, and I'll be like, good, easy, good, leave it. So, and leave it in this particular situation is not don't mess with the other one at all. It's don't be mean, right? Don't be aggressive. And I'll watch the behavior. Typically what happens is they kind of start to play a little bit, and then like little kids, they get a little more rowdy and rambunctious, and then I go, okay, that's enough. Go back to your places. I have them go back to their places and lay down, and then generally that process will start over again. One will kind of creep over, and they'll want to play. And as long as their play is non-aggressive, then I will allow that to a degree, and I'll put them closer together so that they can interact a little bit. And if they start to get too rowdy, I put them back in their places. If you have any aggression issues, then the dog that's being aggressive needs to be corrected. Now, when we're dealing with little dogs, oftentimes the best thing to do, because most of the activity from the little dogs is because they're really excited to see the new dog, right? And so they'll kind of run over and they'll jump on them, and sometimes they'll bite at their ears or they'll paw at their face, which can be a little unfair for the big dog if they have to lay there and take it. So what I do is I recommend putting them behind like a child gate, and that way they can see the big dog, but they can't really interact with them. And usually it takes them a couple of days, and then they kind of go, okay, that dog's boring now. And then I'll let them, if you have multiple dogs, I'll let them out one at a time, and I'll let them interact and make sure that they're good. And then if you have, like, say, three, I had a client that had three small dogs one time. She takes two of them out at once after each one's gone through individually with the dog, and she'll bring two out and make sure that they're good. And then she'll put one up and get the other one out and make sure they're good. Then she'll put the other one back and get the original one. So you got all the combinations of the two sets of dogs. And then once all of them are good, then she lets all three of them out. The big thing is, whichever is the bigger dog, the one that can cause more damage, they need to be under control, but you have to be fair to that dog and not let, for instance, puppies or small dogs bite at their ears and paw at their face and potentially scratch their eyes or things like that. So that's how I integrate the dogs together. This can be a multi-day, even sometimes multi-week process, depending on how much obedience and stability you already have in your dog. But if you go through this process, I've never been able to not integrate a new dog into a household that already had pets. So I hope that's been helpful for you. If you're interested in getting more information on how to train your dog, check out canineacademy.us. Please go over to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and click on that banner so that he gets credit for your sign up. And if you're looking to get a dog, whether that's an untrained puppy all the way up to a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. We did have a little glitch when we hopped over to Jack's website guy, Tom, and our little form to fill out got kicked off the site, but we've gotten that fixed since then. So if you want information on how to get one of our dogs, go fill out that form, click send, I'll get the email, I'll reach out and make contact with you. Until next time, remember, train hard and stay safe.
The only thing I will add is sometimes when the dog pushes a little bit too far, the cat says, I don't think you understand. And the cat gives one of those swats and those claws are out. And you got to be real careful, but that can go two ways. But the way it usually goes is if by then the dog knows, I'm not allowed to hurt this thing. Then it goes, wait a minute, I can't hurt it, but it can hurt me. And it usually is like, okay, after that, I'm done. And that's where we got with Belle. Belle was really hard to break of just being up the cat's ass. Like, she really wasn't trying to hurt it. She just wanted to play with it. And like, I've got an older cat. He's a big cat. He's a bruiser cat. And at some point, it must have happened when we weren't even around because they were pretty good with each other. She must have pushed him. And now when he's around, she's good being about 10 foot away. She doesn't really want anything to do with him anymore. And that works too. All right. So let's talk about the fold card here a bit. And this isn't really to be a commercial or anything. I do appreciate y'all using my links when you sign up for stuff. It gives me a little kickback and all. But I'm doing this mainly because the person that asked us, I think they already had it. And it bothers me sometimes that people don't realize the utility of what they have. So what this person said is, like, if I use Fold to pay my bills through ACH, I'm going to make a quarter point. What's the point? It's not worth it. I completely agree to a degree. Now, there are higher levels using ACH bill pay and getting your money back. If you have really big monthly bills, especially if you run a business or something, might make more sense. I mean, the other side of it is it's maybe a little bit of an extra step, but you have to pay the bills anyway. Most of us are using ACH. If you're paying your bills electronically from your bank, when you log into your bank account, it's the same thing. So, your bank's not giving you shit. And Fold giving you, let's say, a quarter point or a half point, depending on your level, is something more. But that is not the way to make bank with Fold. So the fact that one person thought that means maybe many people would think that. And there's actually a whole series of things you can do that are all easy and no cost to maximize your ROI using the Fold app and card. So first of all, as long as you put money into your account so you have money in there, because we're not talking about the credit card that's coming today at all till the very end, right? This is just the way it is right now for everybody using it. So as long as you deposit enough money in there, you can cover your expenditures. Wherever you go, whip your Fold card out and pay with it. Now, this is a debit card, so you're not incurring a bill at all, but you have to have enough funding in the account. So you have to do a transfer from your bank account or something like that. More on that in a bit. So just every time you buy anything where they'll take Visa, use it. That's it. I mean, I bought $1,000 worth of sausage a few years ago from Tim Love for a workshop and got a whole bunch back on the sausage I had to buy anyway. And then I wrote the sausage off as a business expense because it was. You see what I mean? You start stacking things. Then Whenever you do a daily transaction, in addition to some direct back, you also get a spin. So make sure you do your spins, right? Because they wear out after a while. And make sure you do your daily spin. So even if you don't buy anything, you don't do anything, you just have the app, once a day you can log in and do a spin. And it might be 5 sats, 15 sats, 20 sats, something like that. Sometimes it's a really good reward on a single spin, but it's all sats that you wouldn't have otherwise, right? Then the real ROI right now, when you go in your Fold app, and maybe I should do a video on this where I got a screen share on my phone to walk you through it all, but it's pretty intuitive. There's a place where it says shop, and you can go in there, and they have all these gift cards you can buy, and the gift cards have much higher ROI. So like it's like 2.5% on Amazon purchases. Well, a lot of you guys are doing $400, $500 a month in Amazon purchases just because you are. I don't know why individually, but I know many of you, maybe even more, some of you are buying stuff for your business through Amazon on a regular basis, and it's even higher than that. So you can buy up to a certain amount of Amazon gift cards. Then you just take the number, stick it in your Amazon account. Whenever you order, it pulls from that balance until you run out, and then you have to pay with whatever your current payment method is. That's free Bitcoin. That's 2.5 points of free Bitcoin. Plus, you're going to get spins for buying the card in the first place. And they're for everything. Lowe's has them. Home Depot has them. I'm not saying go buy these gift cards just to buy the gift cards. I'm saying you have a project coming up, and your hardware of choice is Lowe's or Ace Hardware or Home Depot. All of them are in there. Do an estimate, put almost that much money in there. When you go to pay, use the gift card and pay the spread. And then if you're at Lowe's in your military, get your 10% discount on top of it all. Right? So there, that's how you do this. And when you get in there, you'll see this huge list of companies. Now, it's so expanded. If you've got a card but you haven't been using it, go check. And it's even got categories like restaurants and grocery stores and all like that. So you can figure out. What I'm not saying to use the company because it's in Fold. I'm saying when you do business with a company already, you know, even if you don't pay for all of it, you know, buy a $50 gift card to a certain restaurant, you go there and you spend $100, use the gift card, pay the balance the way you would have anyway. And if you have other money in your Fold account, use the Fold card. All right? That's how you start to really kind of amp this up. You also have the ability to enable auto spin, which you go into your settings inside the app to do, but know that it will only work for your purchases. And that means every time you make a purchase, the wheel just spins by itself, which means there is no wheel. It's just an algorithm. But that way you can't forget to do it. Why doesn't everybody do that? Because some people like it. You know who loves to spin the wheel on my app? My grandkids. Even though I get the Bitcoin, they don't care. They just like to see if they can win. So that's another way. Or enable auto spend. That way you don't miss your rewards on your purchases. When you're putting money into your Fold account, don't use a debit card or whatever. They have to charge a fee for that because they get charged a fee for that. Use ACH from your bank or direct deposit to avoid fees. So that way the money gets in there at no cost to you. It might take a little longer that way. But if you're planning things out with a budget, like a grown-ass adult, you know how much money to put in there every month that you want to cycle through the Fold side of spending, right? This is fiat done smart. You're spending fiat, but you're getting Bitcoin in return for it. You also could consider enable auto-purchase for Bitcoin deposits. I haven't done this. I've seen the presets. I don't know if there's a way to customize and say, I only want to do 10%, but you can do something like, say, every time I get a deposit, immediately convert 25% of it into Bitcoin. And you're buying Bitcoin. So what you could do is say, I want to put, I don't know, $1,000 in Fold a month from my paycheck. And so if I get paid twice a month, that's $500 a check. You go to your human resources person, you ask for an additional direct deposit. The rest of your check still goes wherever you want it. So you can have direct deposit go more than one place is what I'm saying. And then that $1,000 would go in, or $500 per paycheck, say $1,000 a month, 250 immediately becomes Bitcoin. You actually earn Bitcoin rewards on Bitcoin purchases. So you could be stacking, bill paying, and double stacking all at the same time. It's up to you what works for you. I don't do that, but you know that's something that's available. Just buying Bitcoin on Fold. So if you get to the end of the month, there's still some money in there. You're going to be bringing some more money in. for the next month cycle, and you're like, yeah, there's an extra $150 in there, and I really don't need it, and I could use some more Bitcoin. When you buy Bitcoin, you earn Bitcoin rewards on top of it. And, of course, you can take self-custody from Fold anytime you want with all your Bitcoin. I like to wait, taking Bitcoin off any exchange, until I'm up around about $1,000 in value, somewhere near a million sats, okay, just to keep the UTXO thing that we won't get into today. Refer friends and for bonus sats. Now, I'm not going to tell you how well I do with that because I'm a podcaster with a big audience, and it would be unrealistic. It'd be like Michael Jordan telling you you can make it in the NBA, right? Like, just because he did it doesn't mean you can't. But, I mean, even just referring a few friends, when they use their Fold card, every time, like, so all of you that go through my link, when you make a purchase and you get a spin, I get a spin. Plus, when you refer a friend, you get something like $5 worth of Bitcoin and Satoshis, and I think your friend will get 10. So using the refer a friend link, anybody you talk to about it, hey, use my link. You know, and if you get 5 of them, you'll max out on your spins, the referral match. So, again, when you get your spins, a lot of times people get the referral match, 5 times the referral match, and they get nothing out of it. I always max it out because I think it maxes out at like 10 or something like that, however many referrals you get. So that helps as well. If you maintain your daily streaks, and what that simply means is go in the app every day and at least do your spin, and as long as you are consistent with that, you get more bonuses and things like that. If you subscribe to Fold Plus, which is about $10 a month, and if you're using it like we're talking about today, you get way more. You double your rewards. You get twice as much back. So it's totally worth doing. And then also watch for limited time promos and boosts in the app. So there's times when they'll say, like, right now, if you buy this gift card to this place, we're doing 10% back. And that'll always be time sensitive, and usually, not always, it will be a significant volume. So it might be like, you know, buy a $500 Home Depot gift card this month and get 10% cash back on it. Okay, or 10% Bitcoin back on it. If you don't plan on spending that kind of money at Home Depot anytime soon, don't do it. If you know you're the kind of person that's going to spend that much money on it, then it makes sense to do it. Right, so I'm not, again, I want to be clear here. I'm not saying do it just to do it. Do the things you're going to do anyway, but do them smart. And if this all sounds complicated, it's not. Once you start doing it, it's second nature. It takes seconds. Watch one less TikTok video today and make yourself an extra dollar of Bitcoin. Well, that's not much. Yet do it for 2 or 3 years and then let Bitcoin keep doing what it's doing, and then maybe you'll feel differently. Because this incremental methodology is this adder. Every time you do this, especially younger folks, you're adding to your retirement. That's how you have to look at it. Your retirement will be better because you took the step. And it's not hard. It's really easy to do. And once you play with it, you're like, oh, I get it now. It's easy. Like, if we're going to go out to a restaurant and they have a gift card, I buy one right away. And then I use it there. And like I said, usually I'm actually buying less than the total cost of the meal because I don't know what we're going to spend. But I'd like, if we're going to a certain restaurant, I know my wife and I, we're going to drop $75 or more, so I'll buy a $75 gift card. You know, I'm still tipping the waiter and all that out of my own, you know, payment method or whatever, but it's just a smarter way to do business. And if you're doing this, and then you're doing like a daily DCA of $5 a day in Strike, and you're participating in value-for-value networks like Noster and Fountain, you'd be surprised what you can stack in a year. And let's say, you know, for all this, which isn't much, you end up stacking, let's say, $1,500 a year. And you should be able to do better. At $5 a day, you're gonna get close to that. And so let's say $2,000. It's $2,000 in Bitcoin stacked that you didn't really have to do much for. And you won't really feel any cost. I mean, the $5 DCA through Strike, that's a coffee at Starbucks. That's a coffee at Starbucks. We adapt to these things really quickly, and when we make them habits, we build long-term wealth. That's all I'm saying. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Again, real quick reminder, the book Laws of Life will drop on Monday, and this will be the last new show till Monday. Of course, tomorrow we'll have a Friday flashback. So get by and fill out the link. And then today's item of the day, I haven't brought this around since late last year, but this is one of the top 15 selling items of 2024. South Chicago Packing's Wagyu Beef Tallow. This is an exceptionally good product. It is a big, giant freaking can, 42 ounces of Wagyu tallow rendered out. I use it for sauteing, searing, and frying just about everything. Even things that I might finish with, like a brown butter sage sauce. I might, you know, sear the steak with this tallow. One can lasts a long time. You can check it out. It's on the website today. TheSurvivalPodcast.com. As always, just scroll down. South Chicago Packing Wagyu Beef Tallow. And there's some stuff in the write-up even about where they source their cattle from, what they're fed, all of that if you want to know. With that, take care, guys. I will catch you on Monday with a brand new show and a report on how Laws of Life is doing. Again, if you can pick up a copy, it would mean a lot to me. Take care. I'll catch you next week.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll